We're back with Backstory, the show that takes a topic from the here and now and explores its historical context. I'm Peter Onuf, 18th century history guy.
I'm Ed Ayers, the 19th century history guy.
And I'm Brian Ballow, 20th century history guy. Today on the show, we're looking at the history of courtship conventions in America. We've been fielding your comments and questions at backstoryradio.org, and our producers have invited a few of you who weighed in there to join us on the phone.
Hey, guys, we got a call from Jenny from San Francisco, California. Jenny, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, it's great to have you here. And what's on your mind?
Well, I have a question that's wrapped in a story.
Whoa.
Ready?
Yep. Okay, shoot.
My grandfather used to tell a story about riding the trolley in Philadelphia as a young man. This would be in the early 30s. And he claimed he saw my grandmother in a shop window and fell in love with her and elbowed the fella next to him and told that guy, there's the woman I'm going to marry.
Wow.
And, you know, as a youngster, I thought, well, this is a beautiful story. But over the years, I was amazed at how often other people told me almost exactly the same story.
Grandmother must have been quite a looker.
Yeah, right. But I've even seen movies that sort of joke about this. It seems almost common.
Well, you know, that's like the whole myth of the self-made man, Horatio Alger.
Sure.
The man who decides by sheer force of will that he's going to marry a particular woman. That epitomizes the whole idea of the modern American male ego.
So you don't think women hung out in shop windows just so they could get noticed?
Oh, certainly. That's not a mannequin. That's a woman.
So my real question is sort of, was this some sort of common romantic notion of the 20th century? You know, what's this about love at first sight? Is this
right? That's the idea. So I will just begin the answer by saying that the idea of love having any connection with marriage at all is a modern invention. That's you could say it begins, it has its origins in the elite classes of the 18th century, that is, rich people who began to cultivate notions of sentiment and love, and then marriages that were in the modern mode between people with mutual attraction. Of course, love at first sight is just a radical way of saying we didn't get married because anybody told us we should or because it made any sense. It's the very senselessness of it that makes it so romantic, and romantic is the key word. But you don't have that in traditional early modern societies because there's too much at stake. So in some ways, we both take marriage so seriously that we talk about love and we then get all this heavy symbolism. On the other hand, we don't take it nearly as seriously as previous generations did.
Yeah, I would just add to that, Jenny. I was fascinated by the kind of moving trolley car and shop window, which is are very 20th century. And you've got your grandfather in motion in ways that he wouldn't have been, at least in the early 19th century, maybe late 19th century. But particularly grandma, future grandma in the shop window. Well, you know, the 20th century is when women started both working in department stores and also shopping in department stores. And what really strikes me as particularly 20th century is that this is entirely about the public sphere. And there's nothing about homemaking here. There's nothing about cooking. There's nothing about retiring to the house. This is all about kind of the merger of an intimate relationship eventually and the public sphere.
You might be interested then in my great aunt. Her sister, who's 99 years old now, tells me that this story is complete bunko. They met at the public pool. Which I also think is a very interesting place for a couple to have met.
Yeah.
Because I guess I really hadn't thought of folks in the 30s at the public pool checking each other out.
But
I
this is what,
of course they would. But you know what strikes me is that looking at, and I thought Brian was brilliant about talking about moving by and then looking at the window and capturing this image, a moving image. I think the movies really provide the framework for this.
Mm-hmm.
Because what he doesn't know is anything about her.
Right.
I mean, wherever he first saw her, it was within an idealized framework. And
literally framed.
Yeah, literally framed. And I think The Window does that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow, that's good stuff, guys.
That's good.
Yeah.
Wow.
If only we knew the truth now, it'd be dangerous.
We love this call. We want to marry it.
Let me ask you, Jenny, are you married?
I am married.
And so how did you meet your future husband?
We were set up.
Ah, a throwback to kind of more of a 19th century
marriage, huh?
Practically arranged.
All right. Jenny, thanks for the call.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
We have a call from Marissa in Lafayette, Louisiana. Marissa, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, pop a question.
Well, my question's actually inspired by a book that I read as a little girl called Sarah Plain and Tall. It's a book. It's set in the late 1800s in the Midwest, and in the book,
I saw the movie. Right?
Oh, yes.
There's a movie.
Yeah, it was an excellent movie. I played the video game.
Okay. Oh,
all right, Marissa.
Well, anyway, in the book and the movie, the main character is this woman, Sarah, and she actually responds to a newspaper ad that this man living, I think, in Kansas, had placed for a wife. And they exchange letters, and eventually she goes to live with him, and they wind up getting married. So, you know, as I read the book, it always struck me as kind of crazy that somebody would actually go and marry someone that they had never even met before and knew nothing about, beyond what they wrote in the letters. But I found out that this actually really did occur, these mail-order brides.
Yeah.
So my question is, you know, what motivated people to actually participate in these marriages?
Right. It's a little bit shocking to our sensibilities that people would make these arrangements at such long distance without love at not first sight, you might say, or
right.
not love.
Well, Peter, doesn't this have a long history back even into your antiquated and irrelevant period?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I mean, it seems to me, even though it was not mail order, it certainly was buying wives by...
Oh, they came by the boatload to Virginia in the 17th century.
Them.
Yeah, well, because, of course, the first settlers in Virginia were a bunch of very greedy and selfish guys. We are in Virginia. We shouldn't say this. And the problem, of course, was an absence of women and therefore the impossibility of passing property on. The irony of this, the wonderful story of Virginia, is that women were brought over in great numbers and developed an important role in passing on property, and a kind of matriarchy developed as a result. Guys would die and women would become key players in the economy and would marry serially, as we imagine men doing in their fantasies.
Marissa, but you wanted to know specifically from a woman's perspective why they would do this. Ed, Peter, any clues?
Well, I think it has a lot to do historically with demographic imbalances, and that's in places like the frontier, like Kansas. There just weren't a lot of eligible women. Conversely, in New England particularly, there was a surplus population of spinsters.
So is that because there were no eligible men around?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Got it.
They'd all gone out west where they then
– where they needed brides.
Yeah, exactly. Really, it's true.
Where, you know, Tocqueville says – Alexis de Tocqueville, the French traveler, he goes to Michigan, which was the middle of nowhere in the 1830s, and he finds people in a rustic cabin in the middle of the wilderness reading newspapers. And I think that's key – to your question, because that is an incredibly important mode of communication.
Yeah. But what's clear, obviously, is it takes two to have this relationship. So it requires a real shortage of women in one place and a perceived surplus of women in another.
Right.
So sometimes this happens because of war, the American Civil War. One reason that New England after the Civil War was so full of women is that many of the men had been killed. And the same thing is true in the American South as well. But I think that it also requires a real imbalance of economic wherewithal. You have to be pretty desperate, I think, to agree to marry a man you've never laid eyes on. And so I think that what you find is that a lot of these people were immigrants in the 19th century.
Mm-hmm.
And they would be in a place marked by great gender imbalance because the men had left, and any prospect of having a family or having a livelihood involved going to where men were because of the way that laws were structured, the way that property was structured, the chances that people had. So all of this, of course, is a derivative of the fact that women were subordinate to men,
yeah.
and they needed men as a vehicle to provide for them and to be able to be a sort of a vehicle of upward mobility. So it's not something I don't think anybody would have chosen.
Right.
I think it was an adaptation to a disequilibrium, either in the nation or more often, I think, abroad.
But Ed, I think it's a corrective to the usual view of sentimental romance that triumphs in the middle classes in the 19th century. Marriage is still about family making. And family, it's a household system of production or at least consumption. You know what you're getting when you get your mail order bride, somebody you really need. Somebody's going to make the butter, somebody's going to make the babies, somebody who's going to make the home work.
Right, as opposed to matching astrological signs.
Yeah, we're not talking about stars aligning and that kind of stuff. We're talking about making a family. So we see it through the prism of romance and sexuality and the kind of choices we make and our sense of our personal dignity and integrity. And that's really neither here nor there, I think, for a lot of people when crunch time comes.
Yeah, this is a business relationship.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Boy, we really know how to take the fun out of Valentine's Day, don't we, Marissa?
All right, Marissa. Thanks for calling.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Love and marriage, it's an institute you can't disparage.
If you're just tuning in, this is Backstory, and we're the American History Guys. We're taking your calls about the history of courtship in America. We're also fielding your comments at our website, backstoryradio.org.
We've got time for one more call today, and it's going to be from our hometown of Charlottesville, Virginia. It's Blake. Blake, welcome to the show.
Glad to be able to be on.
So what's on your mind?
Well, I was very interested in this particular topic. My family's been in Virginia for a few generations,
uh-huh.
and I married a woman from Long Island City, Queens, and had a little bit of a tense time for a couple of years getting my 100-year-old grandmother used to that fact.
Oh, you married out of state?
Well, I married above the Mason-Dixon line.
Whoa.
In any case, I thought, having been a kind of an amateur historian of the Civil War, how difficult it must have been during the Civil War, as well as after the Civil War, for young lovers to overcome the differences, both religious and sectional,
mm-hmm.
Between North and South.
Right.
Well, certainly was the case for many generations, even unto the present generation, that quite a few Southerners would not tolerate the idea at all of somebody in their family marrying a Yankee if they could help it, and partly for Civil War reasons, but also just for sort of general principle, you know, just sort of cultural reasons.
Mm-hmm.
But the irony is that novelists and short story writers instead focused on this as one of the central tropes of 19th century American literature, the marriage of the former Union soldier
mm-hmm.
and the Southern belle
right.
as the sort of symbol of the reunification of the country. And this began in the very first novel published after the Civil War to still endure to the present day, Mrs. Ravenel's Conversion from Secession to Union, which has quite the, you have to admit, the sexy title that
yeah.
anybody would
sure.
But the point being is that like the country as a whole, Mrs. Ravenel, who had been a staunch secessionist, falls in love with a Union soldier and thereby finds her way back into the Union. And that became one of the most common storylines of literature after the Civil War. So even at the same time that a lot of people would never cotton to the idea of marrying a Yankee, it became quite prominent in popular culture.
And how much do you think that the gender differences almost mitigate the military differences? I'm thinking, of course, about the 20th century and war brides.
Uh-huh.
Americans go over and, you know, marrying Germans or marrying Vietnamese in the case of the Vietnamese War. It's almost as if the men fought men and you can make it all okay through these reunions with women.
Well, you know, what's interesting is that after the Civil War, it became very clear to people that white Southern women were the least reconstructed of anybody. Mm-hmm. And it's partly because they could afford to be. You know, they could get away with saying things that really would have put men in prison, because there was still this idea during Reconstruction that, you know, still, you know, these women don't really matter, for one thing. And so their men folk actually kind of put them up to it, to go ahead and resist.
So they're kind of safe in that.
Yeah,
they're
safe. At the same time, they were often very sincere and just despised these Yankee men who would come down. So I guess, Blake, what I'm saying is that you inherited a rich tradition of gendered Yankee hating. But I think it would have been unusual for a northern young woman to marry a southern man. That's not the way the story has often been portrayed. Did you read a lot of literature before you decided to get married?
No, it was oral literature on several occasions.
But I think it's part of the romantic literature, though. You got to meet cute. There's got to be an obstacle. There's got to be something to overcome, or you don't have a story. If you just have people falling in love, what's the story to that? Fact that there are these cultural gaps, and I think we can trivialize it, we can laugh about it, but the marriage choices that Americans make indicate their sense of what the greater American family is really like. And deep down inside, you Northerners and Southerners, you're the same people, right?
Yeah,
now, the real boundary now in the expansion of the mating game, so to speak, is across racial boundaries. And I think we've all experienced, if we're old enough, a lot of this in our lifetimes, of how those boundaries have been perceptibly changing. And I think romantic stories about crossing boundaries are one of the ways in which we codify this in our popular culture. This
I'd go beyond. I'd say it's along sexual lines.
Yeah,
same-sex marriage has trumped even racial boundaries as that forbidden line to cross.
So you were a pioneer in your time many years ago, Blake, and we applaud you for pushing the frontier and being part of this larger reunion that makes us all a big, happy American family.
And I can tell that Long Island City accent has not rubbed off on you, Blake.
No, I'll fight that. I'll fight that.
There you go.
All right.
Thanks, Blake.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for calling.
Bye-bye.
Well, we're always willing to cross boundaries here at Backstory, but the one boundary we can't cross is the end of the hour. But as always, the conversation continues online. Drop in at backstoryradio.org and leave us a comment, a question, a love note, whatever. We'd love to hear from you.
And while you're there, sign up for our podcast and join us on Facebook. And tell us what topics you'd like to see us take on in the future.
The address again is backstoryradio.org. Don't be a stranger.
Backstory is produced by Tony Field with help from Catherine Moore. Jamal Milner mastered the show. Gabi Alter wrote our theme. And special thanks today to Emma Jacobs and Eric Verkerke. Backstory's executive producer is Andrew Windham.
Major support for Backstory is provided by the University of Richmond, offering a combination of the liberal arts with law, business, leadership studies, and continuing education. More information at richmond.edu. Major support also comes from the Colonial Williamsburg Foundation, committed to the idea that the future may learn from the past.
Support also comes from the David A. Harrison Fund for the President's Initiatives at the University of Virginia, UVA's Miller Center for Public Affairs, the National Endowment for the Humanities, Harry Brown Epstein and the W.L. Lyons Brown Jr. Charitable Foundation, James Madison's Montpelier, Marcus and Carol Weinstein, Trish and David Crow, Randy and Lucy Church, J.M. Weinberg, and an anonymous donor.
Peter Onuf is the Thomas Jefferson Memorial Foundation Professor of History at the University of Virginia. Brian Ballow is a Professor of History at the University of Virginia and UVA's Miller Center of Public Affairs. Ed Ayers is President and Professor of History at the University of Richmond.